Good evening and welcome. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, a deadly wave of tornadoes tears through multiple southern states in the latest extreme winter weather to hit the country.
We speak with New York City's mayor about some of his controversial policy proposals aimed at combating crime and homelessness.
And President Biden and Japan's prime minister agree to boost military spending in Asia to counteract China's aggression.
Across the Indo-Pacific, you're seeing much, much more focus on making sure that there is a coalition available and ready to respond should, in fact, we have a crisis in the region with China.
Good evening and welcome to the NewsHour. Rescue crews in Alabama and Georgia have spent this day looking for survivors and victims after tornadoes tore through the region last night. At least 9 people died, 7 of them in Alabama.
The storms also left widespread wreckage and knocked out power to tens of thousands of people. Following a long night, the damage began coming into sharper focus after daybreak.
In Selma, Alabama this morning, evidence of a tornado's power on vivid display. The twister ripped away parts of the Selma Country Club.
You could hear the roar, glass going everywhere. You could hear the roof literally being torn off right over our heads.
Oh my God.
Social media video showed the storm carving a ragged path of destruction across a city etched into America's civil rights history. It hurled aside cars and wrecked buildings. But Selma's mayor said last night that the damage could have been even worse.
We were blessed. We dodged some major bullets. I just want to remind folks that Selma is just one of the communities that was hit by this storm.
The hardest hit of those communities lay 40 miles to the northeast in Autauga County, where all of the state's tornado deaths occurred, and in Hale County, where authorities say around 50 homes have been destroyed. That number is only expected to rise as the full scale of the damage is assessed. Doris Hill's home and business are among the wreckage.
I just moved from that house in September. That house gone. Ain't nothing left on that house but the steps.
All told, the Federal Emergency Management Agency estimated that tornadoes may have touched down at least 35 times across several southern states. Meanwhile, on the other side of the country, Californians continued cleaning up from days of relentless rainstorms while bracing for yet another system moving in from the Pacific. Local officials in Monterey County, located in the central part of the state, are watching the Salinas River, now at risk of overflowing. Nearby communities are under evacuation orders, but some residents are opting to wait it out.
We've sandbagged a garage. Our house is up off the ground, so we really didn't need to do much of sandbagging of that.
So far, more than half of California's 58 counties have been declared disaster areas, and property damage could top $1 billion.
And despite the amount of rainfall, the drought that has gripped the western U.S. is far from over. For more on that, I'm joined by Jeffrey Mount, senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California's Water Policy Center. That's a nonpartisan think tank focusing on innovative water management solutions. Jeffrey Mount, welcome to the NewsHour. As you well know, California has been enduring a devastating multi-year drought. Many people will see the downpours over the last several days and think, well, surely that drought is over. Is that the case?
Well, drought is in the eye of the beholder. This is really something important. It's kind of missed in the news. If you're in San Francisco and you rely on your reservoirs for your water supply, the drought's over for you. They're going to fill up this year. But if you rely on groundwater out in the Central Valley or anywhere in the state, it takes years to rebuild the losses in groundwater we've had over the last 3 years, really over the last 10 years. So, no, and I got to add, if you're a fish, this is great, but you're not going to rebound. It's going to take years of rain to actually recover from this long series, this last 10 years of dry conditions.
Does any of this, the relentless rains we've been seeing, does it help that problem at all, help to build back some of that storage?
Yeah, let me be clear. We are pointed in the right direction. We just haven't arrived yet. It really would take years, like we had in the late 90s here in California. We had a spell of wet years, 5 consecutive wet years. That really helps a lot. But 1 year does not get us out of the drought completely.
Is this rain being stored in some way that can make a difference towards the future, though?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, right now, you've got to appreciate there's more than 1,500 dams in California, so our reservoirs are filling up. Our largest reservoirs are a long way from being full, which is kind of a silver lining from the drought, because they're taking all the water in, and that's actually reducing flood risk downstream as they fill those reservoirs. But they will in all likelihood fill this year. So yeah, we're storing a lot in our surface areas, and we're recharging groundwater, which is important.
When you take a broader view of these several days of severe rainstorms that we've seen and another storm system moving in, we have to point out as well, do you see this as a blip or is this the new normal for you?
Okay, so one of the issues that has come up about climate change is no longer an existential future threat in California. It's here, and we're seeing it. And what we're seeing is drier, dry years and wetter, wet years. So this, like, you can't attribute this, what's happening right now, to climate change, but it is consistent with what we're seeing, and that is these atmospheric rivers get juiced up by the warm air out in the Pacific because they're just holding more water as they come in. And so this is what all our predictions are like. This is what the future probably looks like. And in fact, I would argue the future's here. It's here now.
Well, obviously, we've seen the storms having an enormous impact on the ground. We see challenges still ahead with the drought, as you laid out. You live in California, right? What does all this mean for how you, people in your community, live?
First of all, as you know, we have the most variable climate in all of North America here in California when it comes to precipitation. Most people don't appreciate that. So people run around like it's some exotic event when it rains, but it does. It rains here, and it rains like this about once every 10 years. So what happens in all of this, we get very excited about it, and we worry about it, and then we forget about it by the time the summer comes around. But this year, enough flood damage will have occurred that I'm hopeful we'll tackle that issue instead of just looking at drought. We have to do them side by side. You have to handle the wet years better while you're handling the dry years better. So to our credit as a state, we're working in that direction.
Is that to say that you do see the right institutional and policy changes being put into place to meet the challenges of both those wetter wet years and the drier dry years?
Yeah, well, I'm at the Public Policy Institute of California. What do? We make recommendations on policy. So there's a lot more that we can do. But I can safely say, after looking at this for more than 25 years, we are pointed in the right direction on our policy changes. We still have a lot of work ahead of us, though.
Jeffrey Mount, Senior Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California's Water Policy Center. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
In the day's other headlines, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned Congress that the federal government will hit its debt limit next Thursday. After that date, Yellen said the Treasury will take what she called extraordinary measures to shift funds around and prevent a national default. In turn, the White House urged Congress to quickly raise the limit, now set at $31.4 trillion.
There's been a bipartisan cooperation when it comes to lifting the debt ceiling, and that's how it should be. That's how it should continue. It's not and should not be a political football. This is not political gamesmanship, and this should be done without conditions.
Congress is in recess through next week, and the new House Republican leaders have said they'll demand concessions on spending in exchange for raising the debt ceiling. In the meantime, Yellen estimated that the Treasury can avoid a default until early June. On the war in Ukraine, Russia's defense ministry issued a new claim that a small town in eastern Ukraine has fallen after weeks of fierce fighting. The capture of Soledar would mark Moscow's biggest victory since last July. Ukraine insisted the battle is not over, and TV footage showed heavy fighting around the town on Thursday. Several hundred civilians were said to be trapped there. A top epidemiologist in China is warning that rampant COVID-19 infections may not subside for 2 to 3 months. Instead, he says the virus will spread from cities into the countryside as millions of people travel home for Lunar New Year celebrations. That raises new fears since many of China's rural communities cannot cope with major medical emergencies. Police in South Korea are seeking manslaughter and negligence charges against 23 officials following a deadly crowd surge last October. Nearly 160 people died in the crush at a Halloween party in Seoul. Officials had said they expected more than 100,000 revelers, but assigned fewer than 150 officers to the event. The man accused of assassinating former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has been formally charged with murder. He was arrested after the shooting last July. Police say he acted because of Abe's apparent ties to a controversial religious group, the Unification Church. Today, Japan's chief cabinet secretary condemned the assassination.
Free and fair elections are the base of democracy, and it's absolutely unforgivable to perform an act of such violence during an election campaign.
The suspect was charged after a six-month mental evaluation found him fit to stand trial. Back in this country, there is word tonight that officials at a Virginia elementary school knew that a six-year-old might have a gun before a teacher was shot and wounded last week. The superintendent in Newport News says at least one administrator was notified and had the boy's backpack searched, but did not find the handgun. The revelation came during an online meeting with parents last night. A New York judge ordered the Trump Organization today to pay $1.6 million for crimes including tax fraud. The fine was the maximum under state law. The company was convicted of schemes to let top executives avoid taxes on lavish benefits like luxury cars, apartments, and tuition fees. Former President Trump denied knowing anything about it. And on Wall Street, stocks finished the week on the upside. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 112 points to close at 34,302. The NASDAQ rose 78 points, and the S&P 500 added 16. Still to come on the PBS NewsHour, cancer deaths drop significantly, but more late-stage prostate cancer diagnoses spark concerns. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on the week's political headlines. And a small-town store owner gives her brief but spectacular take on helping people.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Cancer deaths in the United States have dropped 33% the past three decades. That's according to a new report from the American Cancer Society. Among the report's highlights, cervical cancer rates dropped 65% for women in their early 20s, in part thanks to the HPV vaccine. But there are troubling signs as well. Advanced prostate cancer diagnoses have risen roughly 4.5% annually since 2011. For a closer look, I'm joined by Karen Knudsen, CEO of the American Cancer Society. Karen, thank you so much for joining us. Let's just start with that good news. A 33% drop in cancer deaths since 1991. That translates to an estimated 3.8 million deaths averted. How did we get there?
That's exactly right. So 1991 was a high watermark in this country when we peaked of our cancer, for our cancer death rates in the U.S. So since that time, the investments in cancer research by the American Cancer Society, the government, and other entities has really borne fruit in giving us new strategies for cancer prevention, for early detection, which we know is critical for improved outcome, as well as new treatments and in some cases cure for the 200 diseases that we call cancer.
So we have better screening now, there's fewer smokers out there as well, but I do want to highlight that specific 65% drop in cervical cancer rates. That's for women in their early 20s. We know that cancer kills some 4,000 women every year. How much of that decline do you attribute just to that vaccine?
We see a significant relationship between vaccination for HPV and that decline because it's specific to that group of women, that precipitous decline in cervical cancer incidence. So those women ages 20 to 24 would be the first to have received vaccination against the human papillomavirus. So this is the first real-world evidence that we have to show that HPV vaccination does, as predicted, reduce cancer incidence and mortality from cervical cancer. We believe this also portends that in outlying years, we will see that same decline in those who were vaccinated against HPV for other HPV-induced cancers, including a suite of head and neck cancers that affect both men and women.
that is just an incredible generational change. But at the same time, there is some worrying news we should highlight. A 4.5% increase annually in advanced prostate cancer diagnoses. What should we understand about that?
This is really a call to arms for men and their clinical providers to think differently about prostate cancer. So prostate cancer is the most frequently diagnosed malignancy of men in this country, accounting for almost one third of all new male cancer deaths cancer incidents anticipated this year. Now, unfortunately, prostate cancer, although highly survivable if detected early, is clearly being detected too late. We can see this in the shift of diagnosis to men with more advanced disease, when prostate cancer is much more difficult to treat, if not impossible. And it is therefore no surprise that prostate cancer is now perched as the second leading cause of cancer death for men in this country, accounting for 34,000 anticipated deaths this year. So we are anxious for these cancers to be caught earlier and for men and their clinical providers to determine the best screening plan for them for prostate cancer.
A call, as you say, for earlier screenings. But the highest incidence and mortality, we should point out, is among Black men when you look at those advanced prostate diagnoses. Why the racial disparity and how do we close it?
So much to unpack there. So what we do know is that Black men have a 70% increased risk of prostate cancer as compared to white counterparts, and a 2 to 4-fold increased risk of death from prostate cancer as compared to any other group in the United States. Now, when we look at screening rates amongst Black men and white men, they're approximately identical. So we really cannot ascribe this to differences in screening. In fact, screening is low, unfortunately, for all men across this country. That needs to change. So then what's causing this disproportionate burden on Black men? Now, we know very little about genetics of risk overall, but especially for Black men, that's an area where research needs to come into play. But certainly access to quality cancer care and screening may also come into play. And we also know that Black men are vastly underrepresented in clinical trial for prostate cancer, which we know is the most advanced form of care. So many levers that we can potentially pull to bring about more equity and outcomes for prostate cancer. But for men overall, we need to do better.
Karen, when you take a big picture look at this, cancer does remain the second leading cause of death in the United States behind heart disease. Some 2 million cases, 600,000 deaths expected this year alone. It's a mixed picture with these latest numbers, but I'm just curious on your big picture take. Where are we in the fight against cancer?
I would say we are in a period of hope. Each of those 200 diseases we call cancer tells a different story. There are areas like cervical cancer where these wins now infuse enthusiasm for additional prevention strategies. And others like prostate, where we need to understand much more, or early onset colorectal cancer, where we truly don't understand why it is that this is on the rise. So we simply need to invest more into cancer research. We've shown that gives a precipitous decline in cancer death, but we have much more to learn and to implement so that we can reverse these trends and end cancer as we know it for everyone.
Karen Knudsen, CEO of the American Cancer Society. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
New York City Mayor Eric Adams took office a year ago with a focus on driving down crime. His first year in City Hall was marked by challenges, from the COVID pandemic to a homelessness crisis and an economic downturn. The mayor has just released a new $103 billion budget proposal for the city. It's a reflection of his priorities, including housing and public safety, as he shapes his second year in office. Mayor Adams joins us now from New York. Mayor Eric Adams, welcome to the NewsHour.
Thank you very much. It's good being on with you.
And I want to start with the request you issued today to New York State to help with the burden, the influx of migrants, asylum seekers who have found their way to your city. More than 800 asylum seekers arrived in one day last week, more than 36,000 since this past spring. How has this affected the city's social safety net, and how do you aim to address it?
It is a major impact, not only to our safety net, but also our recovery, coming after the pandemic and making sure we could provide the basic services for everyday New Yorkers. As you indicated, 36,000 people showed up on our doorsteps, and we did what any New Yorker would do. We provided for them not only housing, a place for them to sleep, but food, health care. We educated a substantial number of children, and we also providing the necessary mental health support that is needed. But we need help, and that is why we're calling on the national government to not put this burden on our cities. El Paso should not be going through this. Washington, Houston, New York, none of our small or large cities should be experiencing this.
New York City, as you well know, has always been a city of immigrants. You have said that you want New York to remain a sanctuary city. How has that perspective changed, if at all, given the number of governors from red states and even from Colorado, a blue state, who have bused migrants to New York, some of them trying to make political points? But you have said before that that has really pushed the city to the breaking point.
No, and that's so true. And we should be clear that prior to this current crisis, New York State was already receiving a large number of migrants and asylum seekers. This has always been the gateway for those who want to experience the American dream. But that dream should not turn into a nightmare when you're placed on buses without necessary care, no COVID testing, lack of proper food, and just rest to take care of your basic human needs. That is not who we are as Americans. And I was extremely disappointed when the governor of Colorado joined the red states and sent buses here to New York. We had a conversation with him, and he has agreed to work with us and coordinate to make sure that we add our voices to the national government, solving this problem in a real way, a decompression strategy that the entire country could absorb this influx.
Let's shift our focus a bit and talk about crime. You focused your attention most intensely on public safety your first year in office. Last year, New York saw a major drop in shootings and homicides. But robberies and burglaries drove a 22% increase in overall major crime in New York City. What are you going to do to tackle that?
Well, if you go back to February, we were looking at a 40% increase. We were moving in the wrong direction from the time of the end of 2021. And we knew we had to turn it around. And we did a series of things, including putting in place an anti-gun unit, going after our subway safety plan to make sure people were actually safe and feeling safe, and then going after some of those drivers of crimes. And we saw a different direction in the last 6 months of the year. We saw crime start to tick down. We removed over 7,000 guns off our street, of a 27-year high in gun arrests. We went after ghost guns, a substantial increase. But we also looked at how do we do preventive measures, because police can't do it alone. And that is why we put in place real initiatives to prevent people from going down the pathways of crime. We're going to continue that. I cannot take my hat off enough for Commissioner Keyshawn Sewell. She put a good team together, and they executed a well-thought-out plan.
A few months ago, you announced an effort to remove people with severe untreated mental illness from the city's streets and subways by directing police and first responders, emergency medical personnel, to hospitalize people deemed too mentally ill to care for themselves, even when they pose no threats to other people. Help us understand how you see this issue. Do you see it as a public health issue or as a policing issue? Because, you know, there are advocates who point out that the city really needs to approach this issue from a health and housing standpoint, not a policing standpoint.
You know, think about that for a moment. We cannot be so idealistic that we're not realistic. Of course, you need a short-term, mid-term, long-term. Far too many people took that announcement that we put in place as stating anyone with a mental health illness would be automatically compelled to go to a medical facility. And that was just untrue. And I'm so glad you laid out the plan exactly the way we did it. If you are an individual that you cannot take care of your basic needs and you are in danger to yourself, that is an obligation and a humane obligation for us to take care of these individuals. I spent January and February visiting many people on the streets, living in camps and encampments, living in their own human waste, drug paraphernalia, schizophrenic, bipolar. How could I, as a mayor, walk past them? And so whoever's calling for the status quo is just stating that we should do something inhumane. And this is not a police-led initiative. This is led by outreach workers and mental health professionals. People want to paint it as though we're telling police to do this, and no, we're not. We are stating if we come together and combine our forces and give clarity on what our outreach workers can do, we can start saving the lives of individuals.
Well, what do you say to those medical professionals who say there aren't enough beds for psychiatric patients and police who are worried that it puts them in a precarious situation if they're not trained on how to deal with some of these encounters?
I say they're right. I think my health professionals are right. There are not enough beds. That's why the governor announced during her State of the State of her allocation of looking to open 1,000 more beds. That's why we're speaking with our private hospitals and state. We need you also to step up and assist us in accomplishing this task. And that's why even when I ran for office, I stood with Neisner, our nurses, and stated that we have to get the beds back online that we took offline after the COVID pandemic. And to my police officers, you're right, police officers. If we send you out there without the proper training, we are doing something unjust to you with the lack of clarity. That's not what we're doing. We're training our police officers exactly what to look for. We're also utilizing technologies such as what we do with telemedicine so that those mental health professionals can see and give some good information to take someone in for an observation. And this is the right thing to do. New Yorkers know that. We can't continue to watch people all over our country, not only New York, live on streets when we know they can't make the right medical decisions for themselves.
New York City Mayor Eric Adams. Mr. Mayor, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Today at the White House, President Biden welcomed the Prime Minister of Japan as he ended a tour of top industrial and military allies. Japan, like many nations in Asia and beyond, is wary of a rising and muscular China. The two leaders pledged to work closely together on military matters, which includes the remaking of a fabled American military branch in the Pacific. Here's Nick Schifrin.
In the air above Japan this week, Japanese paratroopers train for an airborne assault. For years, they've been called the self-defense forces. But now they're jumping into a new future. And with the U.S. transforming their military to prepare long-term for war with China. Japan promises to double defense spending by 2027. And purchase and develop missiles that can strike deep into other countries.
The extent of investment in the military instrument of power, I think, is historic. In the post-war period, Japan has never put this much resources all at once into building its military power.
Sheila Smith is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. She says 77 years of history,
the surrender documents by which Japan,
since Imperial Japan surrendered and accepted a pacifist constitution, is at a watershed.
What we've often seen in the past is in Japan, you have a certain amount of public hesitancy to engage in too much investment in military power. That has dissipated. And so what the Japanese are really recognizing is they need to be ready in case they have to fight.
Japan says North Korea's missile and nuclear program present a more grave and imminent threat than ever before. Russia's invasion of Ukraine shakes the very foundation of the international order. And China's threats and military expansion pose Japan's greatest strategic challenge.
The behavior of China has really made many Japanese feel that they are behind the eight ball, so to speak, and they really need to be part of a coalition response to that more assertive China.
And so Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida this week launched a Western tour, including signing Japan's first defense agreement with a European country and culminating at the White House today.
We're modernizing our military alliance,
President Biden and Kishida said the two countries have never been closer and praised Japan's shifts on defense.
This new policy was set forth by Japan and I believe will be beneficial for the deterrence and response capabilities of the alliance.
It's especially wonderful to be here in NASA.
And the U.S. Is expanding its commitments. The U.S. now promises any attack in space would trigger a mutual defense provision. The U.S. and Japan will increase training on Japan's southwest islands, some of which are 1,200 miles from Tokyo, but just 100 miles from Taiwan's capital. And the Marines will repurpose their presence in Japan into what they call a littoral regiment. It's designed to be more mobile, better conduct reconnaissance, and fight from remote islands. They'll be equipped with not yet acquired anti-ship and anti-aircraft missiles.
The few, the proud, the Marines.
The Marines portray themselves as the best of the best, capable of responding quickly anywhere on the planet, including for the last 20 years, fighting land-based counterinsurgencies. To focus now on China and maritime campaigns is what a current commander called a revolution.
From the hill fights of Vietnam to the global war on terrorism, 3rd Marines has adapted its mission, its structure, its training. With threats evolving in the Pacific, it's time to adapt again.
The Marines' goal, operate within what's known as the First Island Chain, inside the area vulnerable to Chinese missiles, as some other U.S. military weapons, such as ships and aircraft, stay at a distance. Standing in Marine Corps Commandant David Berger.
You're there side by side, shoulder by shoulder with the partners, with the allies that the U.S. has. You're not leaving them. You're not going back to the rear.
This week, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin provided his most public support for the Marines' shifts.
These actions will bolster deterrence in the region and allow us to defend Japan and its people more effectively.
A senior administration official told me the Marines' moves represents a significant posture change, and Japan's agreeing to the change reflects a major development in the alliance. For more on the Marine Corps plan to take on China and redesign their force structure, we turn to retired Lieutenant General Paul Van Riper. General, thank you very much. Welcome to the program. We've spoken to a half dozen 3- and 4-star retired Marine generals like yourself who voice concerns about the Marines' plans. You've been particularly public in your criticism. What are your worries about the vulnerability, the sustainability, and the access for these Marines being deployed in the Pacific?
The Marines have always been an offensive organization. The few times we've been in the defense, it hasn't gone well. In fact, there's an analogy. In the Second World War, the Marines had a defense battalion on Wake Island. They weren't able to resupply it to provide any support. And of course, the island fell with tremendous casualties and prisoners. What we're talking about now is putting Marines on islands in the first island chain on the Western Pacific. There is no ability logistically, and even the Marine Corps will admit this now, to support them. You won't be able to get casualties out.
I spoke to the current Marine commanders on Okinawa, and they acknowledge some of your concerns about logistics, but they point out that they do not have to do everything themselves, that they'll be supported by the Navy and the Air Force. Will that be possible?
No. There have been articles written where the actual fact, numbers have been done, and it's over 900 metric tons a day, even with the Marines and the joint force, they can't keep them supplied.
Let's talk about the overall strategy when it comes to China. And defense officials I speak to in the Pacific say they support these changes because they need the Marines and the Army to operate within the First Island Chain and make Chinese targeting much more complicated since the Chinese are trying to keep the Navy and the Air Force out. Doesn't that make sense?
No. The Marine Corps, in their initial documents, said this would be a low observable unit. I've looked at all the equipment. There's not one item of equipment that has any stealth or low observable capabilities. Now the Marine Corps is saying, what we will do, we will tell people where those units are as a deterrent to the Chinese. Which is it going to be? Is it going to be low observable, but there's no none of the equipment in that unit has stealth-like capabilities. The Chinese are going to target these right at the outset and take them out.
Marine leaders say they do acknowledge some of the concerns that you're raising, but that if the Marines are going to play a major part in what the Defense Department calls the pacing challenge, China, they'll have to make bold changes and that they're working to solve some of the vulnerabilities. What's your response to that?
The mistake is divesting yourself of current capabilities. And as you know, the Marines have gotten rid of all their tanks in the process of getting rid of cannon artillery, cutting squadrons. Why would you cut these things before you have the capability they claim they will have in the future? So we're going to have a vulnerability gap here of anywhere from 8 to 10 years for an unproven capability.
A senior defense official told me that the items that you're talking about that have been cut are more relevant to invading Afghanistan, again, rather than taking on China, which, again, the Defense Department identifies as the future threat.
All I can say is look at Ukraine. What do we need in Ukraine? They're crying for artillery. They're looking for armor, tanks. They want fixed-wing, close-support aircraft. They want helicopters. Those are the kind of things the Marine Corps has cut or is well on the way to cutting. The Marine Corps in the Western Pacific will be a missile force. It'll have no infantry maneuver units on the ground. What people think of the Marine Corps will not exist. They're rapidly cutting it. So instead of being a force that's able to deploy worldwide for contingencies, it's going to be sitting on islands in the defense. It's an untested concept, but we're actually making the structure cuts and cutting the weapons before we have this capability that I don't think will even exist.
Was there a way for the Marines to become more relevant to the fight in the Pacific without losing that global response capacity?
Yes. What the Marine Corps has always done is it's been a global response force. It's been able to respond globally because it was aboard amphibious ships. It had air alert forces. It was on scene. All of those capabilities are being cut for a promise in the future that those of us who are resisting this and arguing against it don't think will ever come to fruition.
General Van Riper, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Questions swirl around President Biden's handling of classified documents. House GOP leadership provides cover for a disgraced New York congressman as his colleagues back home demand his resignation. And the world reckons with an attempted coup in Brazil. To analyze this week's news, we turn to Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. It's good to see you both.
Hey, Jeff.
So, Jonathan, let's start with this news this past week. Democrats found themselves in a real tough spot in trying to handle the revelations that President Biden mishandled classified documents. The latest reporting is that there are roughly 20 documents found across his private home in Delaware and the private office here in Washington, some marked top secret. He is now facing arguably the worst political crisis of his presidency.
Worst political crisis? Can we just put this into perspective? Especially, I mean, we're talking about this as the worst political crisis because of his predecessor, former President Trump, and his classified documents problem. Hundreds of classified documents at the highest classified markings. And we're talking about 20 documents, classified documents from when Joe Biden was Vice President of the United States. This is apples and basketballs. I mean, those two objects are spherical in nature, and that's all they have in common. And I think we need to, I know politics doesn't do nuance, and most people don't do nuance, but we have to do nuance in this case. This happens more frequently than we realize or we even want to appreciate. Plenty of national security lawyers and experts have gone on the record to say that this happens more often than not. The other thing, and the biggest difference here, and why I downplayed this notion that this is a big political crisis for the president, and that is the sitting president, his people found the documents, brought them, alerted the archives. The archives alerted the Justice Department. They then go and do another search and bring forth more documents. They have been cooperating. They have been transparent. Whereas when we talk about the former president, The reason why we even know that there are all those documents there was because he kept defying the National Archives requests to return the documents. And the DOJ, because Archives had been in touch with the Archives, conducted a search. People call it a raid. I keep my feet on the ground. It was a search. But the FBI just doesn't show up and search someone's home without cause. That is not what happened here. The former president stands accused of basically obstruction of justice. That is not what's happening here with President Biden.
David, understanding the key differences, both in terms of how these documents came to light, the volume, and the point that Jonathan makes, the responses, the different, very different responses of both men, what do you see as the political fallout? Because this is a huge opening for House Republicans who are feverishly focused on investigations right now.
Yeah, I guess I would say not as bad as Trump is not the moral standard our Sunday school teachers were dreaming for us.
And yet here we are. Yeah.
So, but it's not as bad as Trump. It's not in the same ballpark. I wouldn't go apples to, but I would apples and grapes or something. But it's bad. You know, people who have had clearances say that's very clear. If you have classified documents, you go to a separate room. You have an entirely different computer system. They make it very clear of where you can't take them, which is out. And so a lot of people get their careers ruined when they are sloppy with this stuff. And so what Joe Biden or somebody in Joe Biden's office did, we don't know, was sloppy and pretty irresponsible. And so we know some of the documents had to be moved at least twice because the office where they were found in D.C. was not open when he left the vice presidency. So they were moved around in a way they just shouldn't have been. And so should we be prosecuted? We don't know, but I can't imagine. And the standard for Hillary Clinton was, unless you behave in a way that seems unpatriotic and malicious, we're not going to prosecute. That was sort of the Hillary Clinton standard. Mm-hmm. But it should bother us that we now have three top government officials, Clinton, Trump, and Biden, who seem to have done this. And that's just not how government is supposed to work.
Jonathan, a question about the timeline, because the White House press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, has said that when President Biden's lawyers realized that these documents were there, they turned them over to the archives, they did the right thing. According to the reporting, the documents were discovered before the midterm elections. Should this have been made publicly known immediately?
By whom?
By the White House.
And then have the White House stand accused of trying to affect the midterm elections? I don't know. I mean, as a journalist, would I want the White House to release the information? Absolutely. Yeah, they should have. Did they? No. Did the Justice Department? No. But does the Justice Department tell us everything that they're doing in real time? No, they do not. We can quibble over the timeline and wag our fingers at the White House for not being forthcoming in terms of when they told the Justice Department about the documents, or wag our fingers at them for not telling the American people sooner. But we're talking about it now because they're being transparent and forthright. CBS broke the story, but they've been forthcoming ever since then. And I think we should hold them accountable for keep telling us what you know. Politically, it might not be wise for them to tell us everything that they know in real time because facts change. And we should keep that in mind.
On that same point, David, I mean, has the way that this has played out, has the way the White House handled this, has it undercut President Biden's public commitment to transparency?
Yeah, I mean, it's fishy. I mean, they told the National Archives on November 2nd, so they told other people, and they got the documents back. And the elections a few days later, that kind of seems fishy to me. And we'll find out. There'll be an investigation. And it wouldn't be implausible to think they said, you know, this will really mess up the election. Let's just take it and we'll take the heat. And so maybe they did that, I don't know. As for whether it'll have some broad effect on Biden's reputation, on his administration, I tend to think not. It's to me, as presidential scandals go, it's pretty small beer. but it does certainly make it a lot harder to prosecute Donald Trump.
Well, last Friday, the two of you were sitting here with Amna talking about the second anniversary of January 6th. And then 2 days later, January 8th, we saw an attempted coup in Brazil, mounted by supporters of Jair Bolsonaro. Jonathan, what does all of that say? What does it suggest about the future of democracy around the globe?
Well, it says that democracy is under assault.
I mean, this gets back to what President Biden had been saying during the campaign, but also in America's support for Ukraine, that this is a battle between democracy and autocracy, and democracy has to win. But it's not just under attack in Ukraine, it's under attack everywhere. And the fact that followers of Bolsonaro, who is an ally of former President Donald Trump and the big lie, the fact that they acted out on their own version of the big lie should be troubling, should be something that worries us because of what it means for democracy. But also it should remind Americans about the power of the President of the United States to impact not just people around the world, but leaders around the world. I wonder if followers of Bolsonaro would have done what they did if Bolsonaro did not have an ally in Donald Trump who attacked the press, coddled dictators rather than other democracies around the world, talking down to people in his own country, a rhetoric of hatred and in some cases violence. When that is coming from the Oval Office of the White House, that sends a message, not just to the American people, but to people around the world and other leaders who will see, oh, well, if the United States is going to move away from small d democratic ideals, well, why shouldn't I?
What parallels do you see?
Yeah, I'm just reminded, several years ago, I had a meeting with Steve Bannon in his Capitol Hill lair, wherever it was, and it was like meeting with Trotsky in 1905. I mean, he was talking about all these places. He was going all around the world finding Trump-like figures. And he was speaking at their rallies. They were trading information. And he saw this as a global movement of sort of radical authoritarian populism. He wouldn't have put it that way. But it is. It just is. And it flows from a lot of the similar sources of resentment against elites and some legitimate inequalities. But the method it has chosen as a global movement is authoritarian. And it's, you know, a large percentage of people in Brazil would support a coup right now. And the thing that should make us feel a little better about ourselves and about our own system is that on January 6th, our law enforcement people behaved bravely and confidently against the outrage. Yeah. That did not happen in Brazil. And so that shows just a weakness in their law enforcement system, that there seemed to be a lot of Bolsonaro sympathizers who were willing to let it affect their jobs.
Well, the other story dominating the headlines this past week was that of George Santos, who faced scrutiny after admitting he fabricated key parts of his background and his resume. State and local Republicans have called for him to step down. House Republican leaders in Washington, Jonathan, have not done that. We have a couple of minutes left. What does that say about the future of the Republican Party?
The Republican Party is broken. I'm old enough to remember when the Republican Party reflected the likes of David Brooks, people who had values that they stuck by, that they lived by, and that they led by. In the old days, a George Santos would have been driven away from his seat, out of the party, because those leaders would have said, you do not represent our party, our caucus, you are an affront to your constituents, and you should resign. And that person would have the moral fortitude and courage to go out there and say, I resign. But because of the slim majority that Kevin McCarthy has, there's no way he's going to come even close to saying what I just said.
It also speaks to, in some ways, the political utility of shamelessness these days.
That was the exact word I was about to use. And I would say to Kevin McCarthy, just on political grounds, not on moral grounds, shamelessness is contagious. And Donald Trump was it. This guy is shameless. And it will rot out your party from the inside in a way that will be politically disadvantaged, because your moral norms will just slip and slip and slip. And I think it's in their practical benefit to expel the guy.
David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, it's great to see you all. Have a great weekend.
You too, Jeff.
Thanks. For being here.
Rose Rustman has been the manager at Arrow Hardware and Paint in St. Peter, Minnesota for 30 years. She's become a community observer and leader in this town of 11,000. Tonight, Rustman shares her brief but spectacular take on life as a hardware store clerk.
We had a little old man once come to the counter, and his faucet was dripping. I said, all you need is this little 39-cent washer. No, I don't. I go, yeah, that's really all you need. It's 39 cents. No way. So I took a penny out of my pocket, slapped it on the counter, and said, bet you a penny that I'm right. And he goes, oh, big better. Took another penny out, slammed it double or nothing. Next day came in, slapped four pennies on the counter, and said, I'll never argue with you again. I am the store manager of Arrow Hardware and Paint in St. Peter, Minnesota. My mother was in retail, and my dad was an auto mechanic, and so I didn't go to daycare. I either went to the auto repair garage, or I went to Lewis Eastgate, my mom's place of work. I was raised, if you're smart enough to take it apart, you better darn well be smart enough to put it back together. Every day is about the same, but every day is different. So you come to work, you open the door, people come and go. You teach people how to fix things, you help fix their problems. Being at the hardware store entails more than just selling products. It's being a good person, listening to people. Our customers become our friends. We've seen people with their first pets, their first children, and they all come to the counter and they share their stories with us. When I was hired, there was about 15 employees and two females. I was in charge of clothing, gifts, and housewares. And then over time, I liked to learn, and so I started learning more about the guys' departments. I never felt that I had to prove myself to my coworkers. It was never a competition. We were always a great team working together, learning off each other. So in 98, the store manager left. And then my co-workers wrote the owner a letter that said, do not overlook Rose just because she's female. You should give her a shot. And 30 years later, here I am. It's empowering to be able to help other people with things that they're unsure of. I have no plans on retiring as long as I like what I do. I love the customers. It's home, actually. My name is Rose Rustman, and this is my brief but spectacular take on life as a hardware store clerk.
Ms. Rustman has some words to live by. If you're smart enough to take it apart, you better be smart enough to put it back together.
I love that. I love that so much. It goes back to what I always say, everyone has a story to tell. We thank you, Rose, for sharing yours with us. And you can watch more brief but spectacular videos online anytime at pbs.org/newshour/brief.
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. Remember, there is much more online. And be sure to join our colleague, Laura Barrón-López, who is guest hosting Washington Week later tonight. She and the panel will have analysis of Republican Kevin McCarthy's first week as Speaker of the House.
And watch PBS News Weekend tomorrow for a look at the health and financial costs of looming price hikes of the COVID vaccine. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. Thanks for spending part of your evening with us, and have a great weekend.